boiling Britain. Welcome back to Big Mouth, the audio equivalent of a bath full of ice water, pop music and books. As the country melts and prepares for the inevitable 1977-style social turmoil that follows a 1976-style summer, we're here in a baking Soho basement to bring you comfort in the shape of podcast entertainment. If you hear any background noises and clanging on the stairs, we've had to do it with the windows open because it's so unimaginably hot in here. So just pretend it's like an Orb mix with laughing children in the background and birds and stuff like that. I'm Andrew Harrison, and with me as usual, it's Sean Pattinen, the Helen Willetts to my Thomas Schaffernacker. Hello, Sean. How are you?
I'm all right. Thank you, Andrew.
You've been dominating the media this week. You're on the Today programme with John Humphries.
I was indeed, Nick Robinson. I was talking about the Now That's What I Call Music compilation, which was 100 last week. And what it meant for Britain to have this sort of sonic snapshot of music every few months.
What was Nick Robinson's take on this?
Bemused. John Humphries hid behind a screen because, as you know, John Humphries and what he calls pop music, they really don't get on, him and pop music. So Nick Robinson just looked a bit baffled and kept looking a bit baffled, then kept doing thumbs up at me because I had to go.
Yeah,
Humphries, it was great, though.
Humphries can say this to be very much not a settled question, doesn't he, pop music?
No, he can't. He can't cope with this at all. I was on before a rabbi. It was really glamorous.
it's really funny, the Today programme. I was on it once, and it's like a sort of conveyor belt. You know, they have to sort of, you know, turn over items so quickly.
One
you
out,
actually
one
see
in.
People who are in the kind of, you know, the out-room team, the in-room in the middle. It's extraordinary to see, actually.
It's a slick operation.
It is a slick operation. Very much like Big Mouth itself. It's going to be an electronica-heavy show this week, as our two special guests are steeped in wires and bleeps. You just heard one of them there. David Stubbs. Hopping in early in prefiguring later events in the show. David Stubbs is a veteran of Eldie Maker and a long-suffering Arsenal fan who writes for When Saturday Comes magazine. This week he publishes his latest book, Mars by 1980, The Story of Electronic Music, which covers everything from Delia Derbyshire to Deadmau5 in grand sweeping tour of everything that bleeps. Hello, David. How are you?
Fine, thank you very much. Popping a little cough.
That's fine. It's, like I say, ambience. We're going to be talking about Mars by 1980 in depth later, but with your football hat on, what was your verdict on the World Cup? Exactly how long did the feel-good factor last?
Oh, I thought it was an excellent World Cup, and I've watched every World Cup since 1970, and I put it in the top three or four, actually. Exactly, I'm quite sure why, because there were a lot of things wrong with it. There were a lot of, there seemed to be far too many goals and set pieces, far too many penalties, and I dislike VAR on principle intensely.
And then, of course, there's Putin.
And then there was the Putin factor. And in a way, what the most glorious thing is at the end, you know, when those pitch invaders turned out to be the people from Pussy Riot, and I thought, you've salved our consciences here. You know, we've really enjoyed this World Cup, which has been a bit awkward about this, and what a glorious and great thing that those ever very brave women did there.
Yeah. You've established that the idea of that this was a great young team with a great young leader was somewhat undermined by the fact that Gareth Southgate's actually older than Alf Ramsey was. When
he was, exactly. Yeah. But everybody was 20 years older back then, you know.
Yeah.
So it's...
old age, you know, caught up with you more quickly. Yeah. As an Arsenal fan, are you confident for 2018, 2019 under Dick Emery?
Yes, I am. Absolutely, yeah. He's done all kinds of things, much as Arsene Wenger brought in a lot of sort of new knowledge about nutrition and stuff like that into the game. And then suddenly Arsenal was kind of running about 5 or 10 yards faster than everybody else. He's brought in somebody that's an expert on data. He's going to be able to kind of, like, you know, use the kind of stats that you kind of collect in training around players in a really much more kind of detailed way.
So it's the Cambridge Analytica.
Yeah, not it's not just like percentages of passes and stuff like that. It's that's the hope. Yeah, you know.
I thought you were going to say he's an expert on dating.
And you're
going to
have
to couple up with who are really going to help their self-esteem.
So they replace Tinder with like a sweeper.
But you watch. You know, we chuckle now, but when Arsenal are kind of 20 points ahead at Christmas and
Robo Arsenal.
Also emitting sparks from his ears and chattering in binary code is our other Robo guest. Renowned electronic music writer, Mix Mag dubstep editor, DJ and guerrilla A&R person, Joe Muggs. Hello, Joe. How are you?
Hello. I'm all right. Thank you.
You have a fondness for music that sounds like cutlery being dropped down a drain. And you recently put your Balearic money where your mouth is by moving from Rude Boy South London to the New Forest, where everything probably sounds like an old record.
Yeah, it's from junglist to forestist.
that's quite good.
I put my tastes a little bit more on the womp 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 than the clatter clatter clatter. I'm currently eyeballs deep in finishing my book on underground music, which we can exclusively reveal is going to be called Bass Mids Tops and is about sound system culture.
Oh, fab!
Amazing.
And what? Anything new in the world of electronic music that you can tell us about?
The newest thing today I saw was a fantastic video from a kid, and I use it advisedly, I don't think he's more than 24, called Igloo Ghost from Gloucestershire, who appears to have made an amazing video about having his head kicked in by DMT elves.
Oh, wow.
Okay.
And it sounds like... A tiny robot square pusher.
Oh, so, that sounds good. And you're a big fan of Bug of Vesseltoft and Prince Thomas. Tell us about that.
Yes, I have a weakness for Jazz Noodle as well and the electronic variations thereof. I think it's Boogie. I think it's actually Boogie Vesseltoft, which is a fantastic name. I'm not certain on this.
I bet you're right. Sounds right.
My Norwegian is definitely not up to scratch. But there's the whole Norwegian cosmic space disco scene.
There is a
gigantic, including like North of the Arctic Circle discos, which is fully intriguing to me. It's been going since the early 2000s at least, and Prince Thomas is one of the main names, along with people like Lindstrom and Rune Lindberg and
Todd Terje.
So there's going to be some Norwegians throwing their internet radios out of the window as we speak. But yes, it's wonderful. It's really good natured, warm hearted club music. And Boogie Wesseltoft is a kind of electronic jazz fusion guy, and maybe a bit too much so sometimes. I remember seeing him supporting Matthew Herbert's big band, and too many notes, way too many notes. But in combination with this kind of disco smoothness and slickness and warmth, they've made a really gorgeous album together.
I heartily endorse that, and I think, you know, getting that balance between, you know, two genres, and also, you know, jazz and the word fusion, it can be like a collision between an ice cream truck and a gravy van or something like that. And I mean, it's fusion. It can be two things that aren't really, you know, compatible, but it's perfectly judged actually in the music. You know, it's busy, and it's like there's this kind of intense dialogue going on between the two. Sort of, you know, and jazz is always a kind of conversational medium, and it sounds like this is magnificent, detailed conversation going on between the jazz and the techno.
But it's pleasurable to, I mean, it works in this heat, you can just let it wash over
you. Oh, yeah, no, I was going to say, a pure pleasure as well, you know.
Sounds wonderful. Later in the show, we're going to be talking to David about his book on the rich tapestry of electronica, so that all fits in. And he and Joe will be giving us their selections for summer tunes to enrich your holidays. Plus, we'll be looking back at the fantastic NME cassettes, so lovingly compiled by the much admired journalist Roy Carr, who passed away a few weeks ago. All that after this important message from Andrew.
Summer's here, and the time is right to give Big Mouth a few quid on the crowdfunding platform Patreon. It's baking hot down here in this subterranean bunker, so we're asking listeners to help us cover our costs and assuage the sweatiness, and perhaps buy a cooling cornetto as well. If you pledge us the equivalent of a pint of beer at today's challenging prices, that's a mere £5 a month, we can keep the show rumbling along in rude health. Our target is £600 a month, and once we get there, we're going to start recording extra little bits each week for our Patreon backers. So go to patreon.com/bigmouthpodcast to find out more. All we are saying is buy us a pint. Okay, who else thought we'd be living in space by 1980, never mind 2018? If you were born between 1950 and 1980, you grew up with the unquestioning assumption that the future would be futuristic. Space travel, robotics, and all the appurtenances of technology would transform our lives. That assumption found expression in music as well, and it gives its title to David Stubbs' new book, Mars by 1980, in which he explores machine-generated music from Marinetti to Moroder to Janelle Monáe. What are the undercurrents and impulses that make electronic music what it is? We asked David to choose some emblematic tracks to introduce our conversation, but quite frankly, they were a bit too much for radio, so I've chosen a few more listenable ones. We're going to listen to your weird ones later. Yeah. In the meantime...
Thank you.
That was, of course, Donna Summer's I Feel Love, possibly the greatest record ever made, followed by Derek May's Rhythm Is Rhythm with It Is What It Is from the glory days of techno, and finally Up To Date with dubstep producer Laurel Halo and Jelly. Don't worry, David, the Stockhausen is coming on later. So what made you want to write this book?
I actually first proposed it to Faber about probably 10, 12 years ago. And at that point, it got knocked back. But then,
did they say like?
I also proposed at the same time. I also proposed a book about krautrock shortly afterwards, and they knocked that back too. But then they came back and said, "Oh, yeah, we can do this krautrock thing." And then, you know, having done that, they then accepted a proposal about electronic music. And I think it was always. It's never going to be a kind of. I know it says, you know, it says the story of electronic music. It was obviously going to be much more of a kind of a sort of personal thing. It's going to sort of very much my kind of biases. Also, it's not really a kind of a nerdy and a techie thing. It's much more sort of slightly aerial perspective, aerial or subcurrent.
Well, it's
that
a social
kind of
history as much as anything.
There's elements,
like
strong
this
elements of that, and and the nature of it, and what it means to people, the kind of fear and loathing, society, the utopia, the, you know, and the dystopian, you know, the ideas, and especially in its early days, the extraordinary idealism that came with, you know, people making electronic music years before, you know, when it was still an incredibly marginal thing and people were barely aware of its existence.
Yeah. What did you, in the course of writing it, what did you discover about this music that you loved that maybe surprised you? Did you begin to think differently about it?
I think sort of, reading a little bit more, for instance, about some of the sort of the very early futurists and things like that, you know, and just the kind of expectations that people had, you know, with the kind of the dawning of the new machine age, and just how transformative they thought that, like, you know, all kinds of technologies were going to be, you know, and people imagining that people were going to be able to sort of actually physically fly, you know, in a sort of like machine-aided sort of way and stuff like that. And a sort of like a lot of what was, you know, occult, you know, things like X-ray technology and stuff like that, that this was just going to sort of absolutely transform everything. And Stockhausen had some extraordinary ideas about, you know, the potential for expanded human capacity and the ability to travel into space and things like that.
Yeah.
you know, that kind of thing. And obviously in all kinds of ways, I feel it's kind of sad to be living in the post-space age, which we are, really. It's almost like a sort of condition, really. And, you know, and is it possible that kind of sense of, like, future, that sense of space could ever in any way kind of be recovered? It's almost as a sort of mental state as well, you know, a state of optimism, utopism, idealism.
Well, I'm now getting to the point where I'm reading old science fiction stories and old comic books where they talk about the far distant future of the year, 2009, when everything is totally different and people live on, you know, on Venus. And it's, you look out the window and 2018 looks like 1976. It's certainly as hot as 1976. And you sort of get the impression is that thinking about the future is a 20th century phenomenon.
Yeah.
That the future is going to be like now.
Yeah, I mean, this book does kind of come up to the sort of present time, but it was almost, it really is kind of about the 20th century, to be honest, you know. I was half tempted at one point just to cut off at the year 2000, but then I think the irony of when you got, like, you know, EDM, electronic dance music, and it sort of had this sort of stadium rock type role and the sort of ironic triumph that represented.
Yeah. Do you think that, you know, there is sort of within this stuff, there's kind of, you know, much as, you know, rock fans love to delve into the roots for authenticity. Mm. The roots of electronic music can be kind of, in some respects, they're very much alive and present because they're always popping up in samples. In other respects, they're kind of a mystery to many people who listen to this stuff. Is it ripe for rediscovery?
Well, yeah, I mean, especially, I mean, you know, like, obviously Stockhausen is probably still considered a bit beyond the pale, really. I remember interviewing Aphex Twin quite a few times, and I was asking about various artists, you know, Pierre Schaeffer and Stockhausen, never heard of him. He said he was inspired by playing Space Invaders, and, you know, the loops and boosts and things like that. And he was probably right, and, you know, I don't think he was kidding there. But I think there's much more of a kind of consciousness of that sort of music, perhaps in the sort of post-ambient era. I think that people are, it seems an utterly absurd and strange and almost laughable proposition. And there's a lot of incredibly Philistine, you know, comments about, like, you know, Stockhausen, that kind of music. But I think that the sheer sort of sonic battery of, like, all kinds of music over the last 20 or 30 years have perhaps made people potentially more, certainly musicians, you know, more and more going back and listening to that kind of stuff. But having said that, I mean, sometimes with say, Stockhausen, it's the something that he paved the way for the Aphex Twin. And I think he himself had slightly grander ambitions than paving the way for the Aphex.
What I like, though, so you're talking about Pierre Schaeffer and all the early people and Daphne Oram and stuff, and then you bring that to Gary Newman and how, the personal story is being Gary Newman flies to New Zealand Zealand, and the first thing he sees on a wall is Newman, fuck off. Yeah. And so, you know, there were stories like that that then sort of bring that life and bring this idea of this thread of this incredibly pretentious music, as some people will see it, into the pop sphere. And so you're encapsulating all of that, which I really liked.
What I quite liked as well is that it's actually not really about electronic versus rock and guitars versus synthesizers. No. It's about pretentiousness versus dull, grey, lack of adventure and staying in your lane. And, you know, because a lot of the electronic music you write about here isn't really very electronic.
No, not necessarily. It's got, sometimes it's just the components in there. I mean, I did think there was kind of a war. I mean, everyone talks about the Moog synthesizer of the 1960s, but it's interesting you go back to that time and you think they didn't really, it was, you know, they didn't really supplant rock music. I mean, and it's at the end, there's loads and loads of sort of Moog records at the time, but I think it was sometimes a little add-on in like things like Monkees Records or Simon Garfunkel or whatever. Or it was just, you know, the wiki-wacky sound of the Moog, you know, and it was there was every danger, really, of that technology just being this kind of sort of... You know,
novelty.
Yeah, novelty.
The Vuvuzela in the 1960s.
Absolutely, yeah.
Which is why I love it that you went heavy on emphasising Stevie Wonder. That whole, the cosmic soul of the 70s and P-Funk, is what brought science fiction sounds into everyone's lives.
Yeah. So important, Stevie Wonder. And I think that he was, you know, very fact, perhaps his blindness, you know, meant he was able to kind of... just get to grips with, you know, these kind of volatile and, you know, instruments required a great deal of patience, you know, and he was able just to immerse himself.
Well, you see the pictures of him with Tonto's expanding headband in the studio, which is just one giant modular synthesizer.
Yeah.
Joe, this is very much your ballpark. This is your world here. Did you discover things in the book that you, that in your already capacious knowledge you didn't know about?
It's pushing at an open door with me. I mean, I know, word of a lie, the first album I ever bought was BBC Science Fiction Sound Effects.
Roger Limb for the win.
Having immersed myself as a very young kid in my dad's Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy tapes, that was my introduction to electronic sound. There's stuff in the contemporary artists actually that David wrote about that are now on my to-do list. So there's all of the contemporary stuff you recommended that I knew, I loved, so the rest of it is now in my list, basically. This whole thing, I mean, you know, this is a life's mission for me anyway. The pleasurability, the actual enjoyableness of even the wackiest, most far out, most supposedly academic music. It's so important that this brings it out. And I think, you know, I would recommend this book to anyone as a listening list. You know, we're talking about whether people are rediscovering the strange music of the past. I talked to Giles Peterson recently, and he said his Sun Ra compilations are the biggest selling compilations he's done in recent years. Wow. They're really popular, and that is down to Flying Lotus and all these kind of Californian hip-hop producers introducing people to the idea of cosmic jazz. So this stuff is... It's karmic. It's you say, you know, there's this idea we're not progressing. Actually, we're getting to grips with the progress that has happened in terms of information availability and stuff.
Now, you write a lot about electronic music for The Guardian, and you regularly duel with a guy on the message board who says this isn't real music because it hasn't. They can't play, and give them an acoustic guitar and let's see what they can do. And it just never stops, does it? Your Hannah Half piece that you did recently had exactly that.
It did, but actually. I felt that the comments on the Helena Half felt like a corner had been turned. The majority of them, even if they didn't like her music or they were saying, oh, this is like old techno or whatever, they weren't saying techno isn't music. They were at least acknowledging that it was there. It was valid 30 years late.
I liked it when Cole Cut came out and they said, yeah, it isn't music. Deal with it. I don't care.
The slogan on every Ninja Tune release was just isn't music.
Just isn't music, yeah. Mm. It is weird, though, isn't it? Like, from R&B, like to straight up rave and pop and, you know, every rock band that wants to, you know, develop itself, everything is electronic now. We've never had an avant-garde art form like abstract electronics become the dominant worldwide entertainment. It didn't happen with sculpture and poetry, and you don't, you know, your blockbusters are not kind of, you know, indebted to in Shenandoah, and yet here we are with, you know, the avant-garde is now what encapsulates pretty much all music. We ever had anything like that before?
Although, I suppose, I mean, I did write this other book, Fear of Music, Why People Get Rothko But Don't Get Stockhausen, and which I suppose is arguing that actually the avant-garde visual arts, I suppose because, you know, you've got the huge value of an original or whatever, perhaps do command a kind of greater share in the marketplace. I mean, I suppose derivatives of, you know, music concrete and Stockhausen are certainly kind of, you know, ubiquitous and very dominant, that's for sure. I still think that we're still at a stage where, I don't know, listening to something that the work that Pierre Schaeffer produced in 1940, 1949 is still going to present a great deal of difficulty to people. I think there are still sticking points, you know, with that sort of really serious end of the music for a wider audience. But certainly the idea of the ubiquity of electronic music, I mean, it is fascinating. It's kind of an ironic story. And for me, it's Kraftwerk. I think they saw it in 1986. They effectively haven't done anything really since 1986. They've done one or two little things. But I think they stopped recording in 1986. So I think that someone realised their work was done.
Yeah.
Even Bruce Springsteen albums had synths on them. You know, and you know, they could never really do this kind of shtick that they could do in the 70s. Here we are, the electronic robots from the future. We've all got synths now, mates. You know, we get it, you know.
But they go back, it turns 180 degrees, and there's a lovely bit in your book where they're talking about how they don't want the photographs taken because it steals their soul. You know,
technophobia.
Yeah, absolutely. So there's something about that that the avant-garde actually becomes technophobic.
Yes.
I mean, I think the really interesting thing to watch out for now is what's happening on other continents. The most fantastically future-looking music at the moment is coming from kind of African diasporic artists. There's a label called Non Worldwide, which just mind-blowing. It's like what if you can imagine an African Throbbing Gristle, complete with the radicalism and strangeness, but using the absolute up-to-date electronic techniques to disturb and kind of upset people's preconceptions. You know, this is now happening, and it will happen across other continents as well.
Should we have a bit of difficult? David said the S word again. Let's have some Stockhausen.
Yay!
In the air, hold tight, you nutbags. That was Karlheinz Stockhausen, and a mere 30 seconds of the 13 minutes of Gesang der Jünglinge, then a bit of Cabaret Voltaire with Slugging for Jesus, and finally Brian Eno with Dunwich Beach, Autumn 1960, which I believe is your favourite Brian Eno ambient track, David. Yeah. Why is it your favourite?
I think it's one of those things we talk about, like nostalgia for a time and a place that you've never been. Something like that, basically. And I suppose that's sometimes the way that I kind of look at a lot of this kind of music, and I look at, you know, this sort of futuristic music, I sort of regard it in an ironically retrospective vein, you know, it sort of, you know, and it's kind of develops a sort of graininess and a slight sort of datedness with time, you know, and it's, you know, perhaps, you know, the analog aspect and things like that. Yeah, that's one of the kind of emotions it gets in me, really, you know, these future musics that belong very much in the past.
Yeah, but also there's you were talking about the sort of graininess of old electronics and the kind of the patina that it's acquired. I think the appeal of it is that it stands in contrast with contemporary stuff that's all brightly coloured and turned up for your pleasure. You know, everything is designed to, you know, hit, you know, at a musicological level, designed to hit you neurologically and make you feel good. And when you are confronted with music that's not trying to do that, it's really freeing and energising and exciting because you're not being pandered to.
Yeah, that's a very, everything is turned up to 11 and every pixel is kind of super bright, you know. There's also sort of feeling that I get, and that in the 80s and 90s when sampling first came in, it was a very sort of postmodern moment in popular culture, and there was a lot of, you know, it was happening in telly as well with like repeats of The Twilight Zone and Car 54, whatever. But in music, there was this kind of constant hankering back to the 60s and 70s via sampling and kind of conspicuous samples, as if to say that, you know, there's nothing new anymore under the sun, and you know, the great days are behind us.
Yeah.
But now I think it's very different. It's like even with television, you know, you don't really get much vintage telly on now the way you used to. And much, yeah, you don't get that sense that everything seems about 10 minutes old these days.
Yeah.
People just want living in a sort of perma-present, and the culture, you know, it's, I'm not quite sure why that's happened exactly, but...
I think it's the too much stuff problem. Mm. We're living in the age of too much stuff, and it's only going to get worse.
Yeah.
An interesting thing that occurs to me while reading the book is I listened to Paul's Boutique again the other day, which is fantastic. And for years and years, I thought, why don't people make the records like this anymore? Why don't people make records? And then I realised from reading your book, it's because when it's been done, there's no point in doing a Paul's Boutique with the music of 2006.
Yeah.
It's completely pointless. In fact, what we had the kind of the mashup explosion, but instead of rediscovering something that had happened in the 1960s and 1970s in 1988, they're rediscovering things that happened in 2004, in 2005.
Mm. Yeah.
You know, there's sort of time lag, that kind of falling down the time hole into a bigger, different, unknown world, just is not a valid approach anymore. Stockhausen, that track, Gesange der Jünglinge, that's like a 13-minute epic that is formally not music by any stretch of the imagination. It's a gigantic collage, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it is a collage, and it's assembled in a kind of editing suite, you know, and like lots of, you know, scissors and tape or what have you. You could technically... obviously, it's a fantastic debate about whether it is or it's not music. I mean, I consider it organised sound, you know, so in that respect, you know, it's music. Oddly enough, it does... I mean, it makes a great deal of sense, actually, if you're in an auditorium and you hear it live and you hear it coming from sort of various directions, then it actually is a bit like a kind of firework display or something like that, in a way. It actually kind of makes a little bit more sense. I mean, I just love the aspect of Stockhausen where things are just coming from you from any sort of absolutely any angle at all, whatever. But I mean, that's something that people find disconcerting, obviously.
Sorry, are you listening to people listening? It's about it being a group experience rather than a solo experience. Does that make it... better?
I don't know if it's the fact of being with other people that makes it, actually. No, I don't think it's that. I think it's more about the architecture, the environment, and the setup, and, you know, you can hear where sounds are being channeled from.
But you can, and I have, play that track in rave backrooms. I mean, it's as part of a sort of wider collage and chucking other stuff over the top of it, and suddenly the perceived weirdness or otherwise doesn't matter as long as people are milling around and zoning out and going, wow, what's that? And, you know, all the rest of it. It doesn't have to be studied by any means.
It can be part of
a bigger thing.
Yeah. I mean, this is it. I mean, sometimes people, when you get sort of difficult music like this, people think it's like a cryptic crossword or something like that you've got to decode. I mean, it's like Ornette Coleman said the same thing about his music. You know, you don't have to decode anything here, just experience it. And I think that once you sort of let that go, then I think that's a very, you know, that helps a lot.
But also a way in, particularly for that Stockhausen track, is that... lots of the sort of electronic squiggles and burbles and backward voices and layered things are actually enormously familiar. You've been kind of acculturated to them by people who've sampled them or people who've taken that approach. You know, I used to find Autica, for instance, impossible to listen to. And now I found the easiest thing going, because partly from trying, but also because all the things they pioneered have been sort of parceled out, made more palatable later on. And you go back to the source and you find that you can enjoy it enormously. It feels like pop music from a different angle.
They're a perfect example of someone who is consistently pushing it as well. Yeah, and what they're doing now, in 10 years, you're going to find sounds very similarly familiar and friendly, I think.
One more thing that I noticed in the book was, like I say, it is as well as being fantastically informative, it's really, really funny, and it's full of just hilarious little details, such as the fact that the kind of the social realist music of Cornelius Cardew, which I dug out and had listened to, and you point out that his song "Smash the Social Contract," which, you know, a absolute gut punch to the edifice that is capitalism, sounds exactly like Funky Gibbon by the Goodies.
It does. Smash the social contract.
I encourage all listeners to dig it out and have a listen. So David, you're launching this book at a Do It Foils bookshop, isn't
that? That's correct, on August the 7th.
Okay. Well, we encourage listeners to go and check it out if you're in London. It's Mars by 1980 by David Stubbs. It's a fantastic read.
Moving on, throughout the summer, we've been asking our guests to suggest tunes and books that you, the listener, can take away to that luxury yurt in the Peloponnese or that 1813 Gala Shields, because the tunes maketh the holiday and the book keeps the kids at bay. We've asked everyone for a classic summer album, a brand new summer album, and the ultimate summer track of all time, and a beach read too. Now it's Joe Muggs' turn. Here are his summer tunes.
what you're doing, cause I'm about to ruin the image and the style that you're used to. I look funny, but yo, I'm making money, see? So yo, world, I hope you're ready for me. Now gather round. I'm the new fool in town, and my sound's laid down by the underground. I drink a bottle of Hennessy you got on your shelf, so just let me introduce myself. My name is Humpty.
Okay, that was Joe Mugg's summer selection there. We had Digital Underground, Humpty Hump from Sex Packets, followed by Ben Hauk with Get Up to Get Down from the album Only Old. And finally, the soothing sounds of the Gil Evans Orchestra with Where Flamingos Fly. First up, your classic summer album is Sex Packets by Digital Underground. Why is this? I think we can tell.
It's LA through and through. It's Californian sunshine. It's P-funk. It's laid back. It's funny. It's fun. I mean, Do What You Like, which was the lead single before the Humpty Dance, is all about throwing your mates in the pool and eating biscuits and like just foolishness. It's proper summer party sounds. It just speaks of palm trees and pools and fun. Tupac Shakur was their backup dancer.
Oh, wow.
If only he'd just stayed as their backup dancer, life would have been so much happier, wouldn't it? Him and Biggie would have been mates and it would have all been, you know, doing no nose job and it would be great laugh, wouldn't it?
Do you remember where you first heard it?
I think it was John Peel, you know. I think John Peel played Do What You Like.
Yeah.
And it's a 12-minute long jam as well with a huge piano solo in the middle and a fade-out where it's like...
That's one of the great radio jokes of all time is that they fade it out so you can insert your radio ident and then fade it back in again.
And if you are playing this at a block party, proceed to play how you like.
Yeah.
Yeah, I believe so. And, you know, I was already into De La Soul. I had painted the daisies from the De La Soul album on my little ghetto blaster. And, you know, we were talking about Paul's Boutique earlier. It's just that period of unbridled sampling from the 70s. So I was discovering the 70s in retrospect through these records, discovering P-Funk. There's a fantastic Don Letts documentary from BBC4 with Shock G from Digital Underground talking about the one and the funk and the P. All of this, and one day I will sample all of it and make it into a funk tune, just him talking about the funk. It's just unbridled funk. It's great.
I mean, we were talking about it earlier, about this cosmic tradition of hip-hop. Can we get it back? Can we replicate this music? Do we have to? Should we? Yeah. Do you think that could come out now, this album?
I think it would end up being a fairly niche record on Stone's Throw or one of these records. Maybe these kind of labels. Maybe would they have a pop hit with it?
Hip hop's got so serious, hasn't it?
But life's got serious. Maybe that's it.
It's exactly it. Actually, unfortunately, this is it. I think that sometimes you know people's sense of political well-being or whatever, or optimism about life generally can kind of affect the kind of music.
I don't think that's necessarily true. I mean, look at Race Remmord. These two kids, and they are kids, who have had some of the biggest records of the last couple of years. They're party records. Yeah. They are about having an absolutely smashing time, taking loads of ecstasy and getting off with girls.
But
it's moved on. These are Southern Atlanta-style trap beats. It's just a very different form. So sample-based hip-hop is for us grandads, you know.
So your brand new summer album is Ben Hauk. Can you tell me what he's all about? Tell us.
He's a southeast Londoner from Lewisham, and he's very much representative of this kind of... emphasis on jazz in London at the moment. There is much great jazz-based music, whether it's like actual live players like Nubia Garcia and Shabaka Hutchings, and like they, you know, there's all of these guys.
There's a bit of a scene.
There's a huge scene. It's immense, and it's all for dancing. It's like people playing live jazz for nightclubs, Servants Jazz Quarters, and Plastic People. R.I.P. was kind of the crucible of all this, where people would play deep jazz records and people would dance to it, you know, much like Giles Peterson was doing in the late 80s.
What a radical idea, a music that was actually invented for dancing to. People are dancing to it.
Absolutely, and very young people are instrumentally adept and are playing stuff that just... the 22A Collective in Peckham are incredible, and they see no boundary between electronic production and live jazz playing. It's just natural to them all. They grew up on Garage and Grime and all of this sort of stuff. And Ben Hauck is a very good example of it. The track that we played there is the most straightforward on the album. It's very kind of, you know... wafty holiday advert deep house and nothing wrong with that at all, but the rest of the album, the beats kind of fracture a bit more. There's a bit heavy Brazilian influence, there's this kind of like Flying Lotus from Los Angeles, this kind of very psychedelic cracking up of hip-hop rhythms into weird syncopations, and it's just, you know, this is clearly what comes naturally to the guy as from all the music he's been immersed in. There's no kind of grand concept or we are inventing something mad, but actually it's quite radical.
It's real, man.
Yeah, so that's Ben Hauke, which is H-A-U-K-E, if the listeners want to search it out on the internet.
Go and see live. Sounds quite good. And the ultimate summer tune of all time from you is the Gil Evans Orchestra with Where Flamingos Fly. So what's the story here? Why is this the ultimate one?
Mainly because, well, first you just hear it and it's one for passing out in the insane heat. It's for when you just can't handle the heat anymore. You can't move.
I think
all you can do is all you can do is reach for a mint julep or whatever your ice drink of choice is. But also, I think because I was introduced to it by a flatmate in Brighton in the summer of '95, which was a very hot summer, and we spent an awful lot of time just sitting on a porch drinking heavily and smoking heavily, and this is just ideally suited to that precise situation.
So do we all think that, you know, the hotter the summer is, the different music we'll be listening to actually changes what we're listening to right away?
It's like temperature rises, propensity to listen to jazz increases.
Yeah, that's what I'm getting at. Yes, it's proportional.
Yeah. I think so.
Yeah, I definitely think so. You know, the windows are open, whatever, and
you can't
the sort
move.
Of sense of like, the heat streaming or whatever. Yeah, and it certainly enhances, you know, music that's kind of, you know, got those kind of, yes.
Yeah, it definitely, I mean, I'll be interesting to see some sales figures because, you know, I think my second choice, I think, for a modern album was going to be the new Pop Khan album, which is the superstar of dancehall at the moment. And it's actually a very laid-back album. Yeah. And if your tolerance for auto-tune vocals is relatively high, it's brilliant. And it just feels purpose made for this summer. I've already heard it out at lots of cars, and it feels like he will benefit from the sunshine greatly in terms of sales or streams.
Fabulous. Your recommended beach read doesn't sound like a great laugh, though. It's Twitter and Tear Gas, The Power and Fragility of Network Protest by, now I may get this wrong, Zeynep Tufekci?
I believe so.
Something, tell us about that.
She is a Turkish academic now in America. She was present for the recent anti-government, well, a few years ago now, anti-government protests in Turkey, has witnessed close-up various activist movements. She's a technology expert. She was warning about the sort of stuff that is now common currency in Cambridge Analytica and all of this from 2012, from when Obama's campaign weaponized social media. And she was saying, if liberals can do this, so will other people. And, you know, she was warning very strongly about this. And so she's kind of a prophet of our times. She's a great realist. She, you know, she's very emphatic that Russia couldn't be doing what it was doing if it wasn't pushing at an open door in terms of racism and paranoia and rising fascism and blah, blah, blah. It's not exactly optimistic reading, but it helps you feel like you've got a bit of a grasp on some of the things that are just too horrifying to think about.
I'm not going on holiday with you. This is beach down.
Does it make you feel like Twitter, it'd probably be best if it were ultimately kind of shut down and sealed like a rusty old sewer or something?
No, because, like I say, she's a realist, and that includes knowing all of the benefits that Twitter has given voices to the marginalised, ways of organising, all of these things. You know, there are values to these tools, and we are in the process of negotiating, just like around the French Revolution they were negotiating the aftermath of the printing press and pamphlets and all of this, you know, and it reminds you that there's a grand historical sweep, and that what seems like crisis now could or could not turn out to be.
Yes, it sounds very, very deep. The weakness of the connectivity of our world.
Well, I shall be working on my new book, Towards a New Luddism. Disinvent Everything. Which brings us to the cassettes. Now, in early July, we heard the news that the Enemy journalist Roy Carr had passed away. He was a much-loved part of the Enemy's furniture from the late 1960s through punk and into the 1980s. He interviewed the everybody in the rock canon, Springsteen, Lennon, Led Zeppelin, Keith Moon, the lot. But for a younger generation, his biggest contribution that you might know was compiling the Enemy's fantastic series of compilation tapes, which added up to a correspondence course in electrifying new music at a time when otherwise you could only get it on John Peel. Roy Carr compiled around 40 of these cassettes, which included everything from multi-genre tapes with names like Mighty Reel and Mad Mix 2 to comprehensive introductions to new or different genres with whose own titles told a story. Neon West, All Africa Radio, Straight No Chaser, or I Dreamt I Was Elvis. I never knew Roy Carr, but I owe him a debt, and if you're listening to this show, you probably do as well. We're going to talk about the Enemy tapes after a few choice tracks that got their biggest exposure on a cassette that you had to send off for in the post by collecting tokens. Gritty Politti with The Sweetest Girl, which debuted, I think, on CAT1, one of the earliest Enemy tapes. Then from Dancing Master, Feel Up by Grace Jones. And finally from the brilliant, brilliant introduction to reggae, Smile Jamaica, which literally changed my life, Miss Jamaica by Jimmy Cliff. David Stubbs, did you know Roy Carr back in the King's Reach Tower days?
I did. I arrived at Melody Maker in 1986. Of course, it was Enemy, but then everybody went to sort of King's Reach Tower, and then later on there was Uncut. So I suppose from the sort of early to mid-1990s, he was a kind of a feature around the office. He was a very genial bloke. I mean, he was, you know, I think it's interesting, you know, he's one of the most important of rock journalists, but one of the least self-important. Yeah. And I think in a way, you can almost take him for granted when he was around the office. It's a bit like the character, the Uncle Tom character in the Rumpole and the Bailey series, you know, these elderly old lawyer who just prattles around, hangs around the office and just chats to people, tries to, you know, reminisce to people when they're trying to work. And there's an element of that about Roy. And I really feel bad about that now, because his stories were just magnificent. You know, they made our kind of pitiful little meeting, My Bloody Valentine, down the pub. Absolutely pale. I mean, because the thing about him is, and it just meant nothing to him, because people like the Beatles and the Stones and the Who and Keith Moon, all these people, he'd been a musician himself in the early 60s, and they were just all coming up together. You know, he was in this group called the Executives. And so they were just... You know, these people weren't kind of, you know, way up there on kind of plinths or anything. They weren't legends. They were just friends. And
didn't Roy Carr once write a review of the Rolling Stones when they were supported by the Executives and said the Executives blew them off stage? I'm sure I read
possibly,
this somewhere.
Yes, it's a good mischievous, apocryphal, I don't know. But he was renowned for having, you know, this tremendous notebook. You know, you just knew everybody. And so in the early 70s, you know, say Enemy was short of a cover, he said, well, I'll just go around and have lunch with Keith Moon. And then you go and have lunch with Keith Moon, write the whole thing up, and there's your sentence spread. And it was just very, very informal. There was no going through press officers or anything like that. There was it was just, you know, it didn't have to be tied in with any particular release or anything. Yeah, it was just, and I think that was just so matter of fact, so casual with him that you know, like I say, it's, and he didn't really sort of have any kind of superior airs. Of course, my generation had far more going for it than yours. He was a very, very friendly, open, honest guy. And but I think one of the strengths of these tapes, I'm sure he wasn't personally responsible for each individual selection, but again, he was just brilliant in terms of networking, being able to kind of arrange. I mean, I wouldn't know, and I could make a wish list for one of these sets, but I wouldn't know where to begin in terms of making the actual necessary approaches to the people. I mean, he would have known everybody, and he would have just done it as, you know.
Even though you were a team maker, did you get the tapes yourself? Because I know you had a weakness for high voltage.
Oh, no, absolutely, yes. Mm. Yes, absolutely. And I mean, that particular one, although at that point, you know, I'd probably be painfully insufferable to stop it. Oh, something's a little bit obvious to me. but I mean, it's a tremendous selection, and at that time, it really is. And because especially, I think, you know, like Noi wasn't particularly available at that time. The C81, I mean, that you played, I mean, that was an absolute revelation. Like you say, you actually had to cut out these coupons and send them off.
There was a great sense of waiting as well.
Did you get it for a sort of £2.49? What an absolute bargain it was.
Yeah.
And that initial track, you know, that's when Scritti Politti made their kind of transition from sort of very scratchy sort of Marxist-type post-punk into full-on pop, you know, and to discover this facility for melody and beautiful vocals, whatever. And that early version that you played is slightly different from the more
polished,
more polished one. And I prefer that because it just reminds me of just putting this cassette on and just immediately being kind of blown away.
I've dug out my copy of Dancing Master, which I sent away for sound effects. You can hear it, bits of cassette being battered around there. And it's just such a lovely item. It's got incredible, sort of beautifully designed cover artwork. And the track list: Tom Brown, Funkin' for Jamaica, Lynx, Grace Jones, Feel Up, Talking Head Cities, Elvis Costello and the Attraction's Big Sister, Funky 4 Plus 1, That's the Joint.
Oh,
I mean, this is like
an
amazing kind of madness. Yeah. Shadow on the House, the one when they tried to do country, Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five, B-52s, Give Me Back My Man. I mean, this is just, why can we not get this on a cassette, on a CD reissue now?
Yeah,
those
of
this is absolutely impossible to get hold of. Joe, you're probably a bit young for this stuff. Are you aware of these things?
Vaguely, only, you know, I was aware that they existed. I mean, reading up for this programme, I was actually blown away by the track list. So I think I started buying the NME in 87, so 87, 88, so just after the cassette era, really. But, you know, looking at this now, it's beautiful. It's you could almost think it was a 2018 hipster creation, because, of course, lots of people buy cassettes now, and you could just see a wall of these in some Peckham Cool Kids flat.
Yeah. Well, but also, the broad range of these things represents the sheer eclecticism of, you know, people like Enemy in the early 80s. And, you know, there were jazz ones, fantastic introductions to jazz as well. And I first, you know, would have heard like Charlie Parker via one of these cassettes, you know, Wes Montgomery and people like that. So you had that as well. I mean, Enemy had Sun Ra on the cover in the early 80s. But, you know, at that point it was selling insufficient numbers that they could sort of really, you know, we'll say indulge, not really, when they could really stretch themselves in that way. As the 80s wore on, as music sales gradually began to kind of decline, there was a strong, strong pressure for all the music press to become more fixated on white rock, white male rock mostly, you know, culminating obviously in the dominance of Oasis. And all of this kind of diversity, unfortunately, you know, went by the wayside. It was considered, it wasn't considered profitable. There came a point where, you know, they could measure. It's basically what a black person on the cover, you know, they say, well, you know, that sales would dip if you did that. So, so basically, there's fewer black people on the cover, for example. I mean, you know, Melody Maker, we said, well, so they'll dip one week. You know, you can't have Beatles on the cover every week. You know, it's we tried to do that, but there was a lot of pressure, you know, on NME, perhaps even more than Melody Maker, just to kind of create a more kind of white, indie, rocky, conformist line. And that just eventually ended up dominating. Yeah. You know, so these are kind of relics from a much more kind of diverse and rethinking musical era.
Sean, you were, you know, quite proto-indie in those, and you're on Smash Hits as well.
No, I was at school. when these came out. And how old do you think I am?
You were at school then. I don't know.
Hey, Proto-Indie. Were you
aware of these tapes?
I was aware of them. I don't think I actually did send off for them. £2.49 is quite expensive.
Quite a lot of money in those.
Yeah,
things,
I mean, you know, if you've got to buy sweets as well. Yeah. I've got C86 when it came out on vinyl, you know, and that's really not very cool, is it? I didn't
send
off
that cassette.
Well,
that's one we haven't mentioned yet. The C86 basically invented contemporary, codified contemporary rock, didn't it?
Yes, yeah. Absolutely. And I did listen to that a lot, sadly, because that's what I was into at the time.
I mean, C86, I didn't like it. I mean, you know, it's that to me.
It's not the cool one.
I mean,
it,
because it just sort of emphasised how kind of small post-punk, small and grey it had become. Mm. You know, Wedding Present, House Martins, with this emphasis on a sort of miniature dreariness that I just found at that stage, you know, a bit kind of insufferable.
I like that miniature
dreariness. But it's certainly, it certainly did a very good job of, like, you know, introducing you to a sway of the bands that were actually happening, that's for sure.
And it set a template as well for the next few years and what NME was going to do and what it was going to be.
Yeah.
The ones
until Acid House.
I think they did, but I think the tapes had just ended when Acid House was arriving. They did a vinyl send away, which was a bit too expensive, I think. I don't think I got it. But, you know, the ones I used to love more than anything were the miscellaneous. Mighty Reel had Sensation by Yellow, Billy McKenzie and the BF doing Secret Life of Arabia, Robert Wyeth doing Round Midnight, and Rocker's Revenge doing Walking on Sunshine. It hadn't come out before. I mean, this is like the future greatest hits. You know, there were such beautiful things. The design, you know, Ian Wright illustrations, Sergei Clark illustrations, and brilliant titles like Raging Spool and Racket Packet and Pogo A Go Go. You know, so much energy and creativity going into it. I mentioned earlier the Smile Jamaica one. This was they did it for the 21st anniversary of Jamaican independence, and there was one track per year of Jamaican independence, starting off with Calypso, going through ska, you know, roots reggae, right the way up to Black Uhuru, which was then state of the art. And this, to me, just became a total roadmap of these were all the records I was going to buy. And then you kind of compare and contrast it with the sort of the free CD era that came later. And I had to work on a lot of these magazines. And the kind of brief would be, put together a CD that's got all the biggest tracks of the year on it. And you think, well, they're reading a music magazine. Why do they need that? Surely, if they're really interested in Coldplay, it's odds on they might already have Yellow.
or who's advertising in the mag this month.
Well, not even that. You know, it was just kind of became this sort of feedback loop of, you know, confirming people's beliefs
once in a while it can really work. I mean, I still play, there was one that Uncut did in the early 2000s when the whole freak folk thing was happening and Folktronica, and it was basically all friends of Devendra Banhart or influences thereof, so it was like some old 60s psychedelic folk and some Folktronica and some up to date acoustic weirdos, and it's a great CD, and if you do that, if you theme it, and there's a guiding influence, it can be done, and obviously, you know, this is what was happening with these tapes.
Well, Mojo does a really good job with it, and you know, they can put together some fantastic like music guides and CDs themed around a person or a particular year. But to me, the problem is that like this stuff is now so ubiquitous. An NME tape was a once they did one every quarter, I think. They were rare. They were you looked forward to it, and you had that thing of saving up the tokens and being very excited. And when it arrived, you poured over it to the extent that all mine are now ruined because they got chewed up by the cheap cassette players. And so in a sense they're a little bit rosebuddy. You know, I wish I had a working copy of you know, Mighty Reel or Mad Mix 2 that I could listen to properly. It was the fact that it was a special experience rather than, okay, it's the start of the month and there's three CDs free on the front of magazines. Mm. Are you ever going to actually listen to them? Are you ever going to get time? I mean, when I used to compile CDs for Word, and I took the NME tapes as a kind of inspiration of how to do it. You know, mix up people that you've heard of doing something unusual with things that you know they're going to love. Terribly exciting. They need to bring them back on CD because they're pop music history.
You're back in the room. Andrew, snap out of this, Okay, fine. Let's move on. Well, let's have some more summer tunes. What will our guest, David Stubbs, choose for his classic summer album, his brand new summer album, an ultimate summer tune plus beach read? There's only one way to find out.
They say that heaven is there's no one at home. While I'm out walking up there on my own, sunlight glints through the butter knife clouds, salt squalls bulrush the sage purple hills. It's misty but not raining yet. That fizzle of drizzle, once a threat, now a promise.
Welcome to David Stubbs' Super Sore Away Summer. That was Summer by Pub, David Ultimate Summer Tune, because it's got summer and pub in it, probably. Hooray! Followed by Stevie Wonder and Heaven is 10 Zillion Light Years Away from classic summer album Fulfilling This First Finale. And then Pete Williams with Wind Whispers, or Wind Whispers maybe, from Holland, David's new summer favourite. Okay, Summer by Pub. This is very hard to Google. What on earth is it?
Yeah, I mean, Pub. They were just called Pub. I know.
It's, of course, very hard to, indeed.
Exceptionally. Yeah, and I don't think it's a very good name, to be honest, to call yourself Pub. I mean, it sounds all wrong, really.
You should sound like El Brutus if you're called Pub.
Yeah, I mean, the word Pub, it obviously has a kind of, I mean, I suppose the pub does kind of excite sort of very pleasurable sort of synaptic sensations, but it doesn't necessarily feel appropriate with this. But yeah, just called Summer, and all pretty straightforward.
Who are
but
they? Where are they?
I've never known.
How did
it's from about 2000, is this? Mm. It's
right.
From there or thereabouts, and a couple of other things. But yeah, just somebody who sort of drifted in and drifted out. But, you know, they bequeathed this magnificent 16, 17... You know, it is just like, you know...
How long is it? 16 minutes?
It's something, I think it's there or thereabouts. Yeah.
It's longer than the average British summer.
Absolutely. Well, this is it. You know, and it just feels like you're in some sort of submarine turquoise paradise, you know, while it's 38 degrees out on the beach. And it's just constantly relentlessly just bubbles through. And, yeah, and it's just one of the sort of purest expressions of, like, you know... Of warm weather transcribed into music that I've ever experienced.
Really. So to sum up, you don't know who they are, you can't remember how you discovered it, and you don't know where the listeners
hoved in.
And if the listeners Google Summer Pub, they're just going to get a load of beer garden.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's actually, you know what, that's marvellous, actually.
But
I think it is great, actually, that sometimes that everything's not broken down to, like, you know, Wikipedia fact or whatever. You know, I like it. I've never particularly been interested to sort of, like, find out the humdrum details of, like, you know, what their names and addresses.
Someone from Pub, hopefully, will be listening and going,
yes,
finally,
at last.
If you're a member of Pub, give us a shout.
Yes, please do.
But, you know, that's the nature of that music. It isn't, you know, it isn't sort of autobiographical. It isn't about the sort of, you know, the individuals that make it, the heroes that do it. It's just these kind of anonymous, immersive experiences.
And actually, it's a very recent thing, isn't it? The idea that you've got to know the inside leg measurement of the bass player.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, 100 years ago, nobody was going, did you know that Crumhorn player also used to play in another bunch of magical artists?
I think everything's felt obliged. There's an obligation, a lot, anticipate everything to be a slightly more enhanced Wikipedia entry in some ways, and everything's got to have that kind of apparatus of scaffolding of facts. And I mean, when I wrote in the late 80s, facts were hard to come by. But quite often, you had clippings from the library, but they were probably recycling, you know, spurious nonsense or whatever. And I did a piece on Big Black, and it was just mostly adjectives. And I put one fact in the middle of it, in around the 1500 word mark. I said, Big Black is splitting up because the basis is going to law school, and then went on with the adjectives. And I mean, a lot of journalism, probably if you look at the sites like Rockback's Pages and you look at stuff from the 70s and 80s, from a research point of view, you'll think, well, I'm glad you all had a jolly good drink down at the mansion, but I've got nothing here I can use.
This is also why lots of people still believe that Bob Holness played the sax solo on Baker Street.
Absolutely, yeah.
And why not? Tell us about Stevie Wonder and Fulfilling This's First Finale.
Yeah, it's the slightly forgotten Stevie Wonder album, coming between Inner Visions and then Songs in the Key of Life, which came out in 1976. You know, this was released in July of 1974, I'm pretty certain, anyway, but certainly in July. I bought it in July of 1978. I had to save up 4 weeks of paper round money to afford it. And I remember flicking and thinking, if I don't like this first, by golly, I'll learn to like it. But fortunately, it's Stevie Wonder, so there's no problem there. So for me, I mean, there is an absolute association with, you know, with this music, you know, with summer, you know, with sort of, you know, the bright oranges and yellows and sort of misty mellowness and what have you. And but, you know, like Heaven is tensing in that way. When it's got absolutely, it's got Boogie On Reggae Woman, you know, absolutely superb, you know, piece of sort of mode-driven reggae. And You Haven't Done Nothing, which is this big kind of anti-Nixon diatribe, and it just absolutely splashes through. For me, I think, you know, I think that perhaps, you know, the time it came out, you know, it was probably sort of, you know, looking at that kind of sort of, you know, launched into that particular climate, that particular time. And yeah, in the time when I first listened to it, I just remember, you know, again, you know, coming, you know, racing back home at about getting home at 4:30 or whatever, you know, windows open, blasting it out, and just, you know, and then being called out with my tea at 6 o'clock.
So what, in your opinion, went wrong with Stevie? Why did he fall apart? And
yeah.
I just called to say,
I think that... what's curious about Stevie Wonder is if you listen to something like I Feel Love, and you think that there's a kind of whole rhythm revolution going on there, Stevie Wonder, those losing all the art and most synths, the rhythms are actually fairly conventional. Ding, 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 ding. It's just a sort of conventional drum kit. And I actually think that Stevie Wonder was victim of, you know, the sort of the disco, the sort of sequence of revolution, really. His music was actually, didn't really particularly fit in with that. He also stopped working with Margolev and Cecil after. He doesn't work with them on Songs in the Key of Life. It's because he's only about 25 or 26 at this point, and he's just left behind this massive legacy.
Yeah, yeah.
And then, after that, he's just very intermittent. He doesn't, you know, obviously he does I Just Call to Say I Love You, and a few things like that. You can still find, you know, it's pretty bad, and you can still find one or two great Stevie Wonder tracks, if you look, you know, in the 80s and even the 90s.
Some of the Paul McCartney collaborations in the 80s.
Yeah,
actually,
yeah.
No, there was one on the Tug of War album. I forget the name of the track. What's That You're Doing? It's pure funk. It's the funkiest Macca's ever been, and it's an amazing track.
I saw him. I remember seeing him live, and he's absolutely in the late 80s, early 90s, and he'd still absolutely got it, you know, in terms of absolutely brilliant live performance. It just suddenly dries up, and he's only in his mid-20s.
Of course, he did have that crazy electronic moment with The Secret Life of Plants and Race Babbling,
Race
which is proto-house.
Race Babbling is superb.
And if he had continued down that line, God knows what could have happened. The track you just played is part of one of my very favourite micro-genres, which is soul singers sounding like they're playing their own record too slowly. Isaac Hayes is very good at it. Teddy Prendergrass is very good at it. And it brings to mind all those kind of Houston hip-hop DJs high on cough syrup who play the records too slow.
RPM soul.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a compilation tape. Yeah. So your new summer album, I call it Holland, but it's actually Holland, is it? By Pete Williams, who used to be the Dexys in the Bureau. Tell us about that.
Right. Yeah. This is something I sort of touched on very recently, and it's I actually just review it for Classic Rock. In fact, I did it kind of pretty much, you know, on spec. And it should be antithetical to everything that I'm kind of gassing on about. You know, electronic is a very un-electronic record indeed. To be honest, it's not an especially summery record. However, that's kind of the point at the moment. This summer is really getting on my man boobs. It really is. It's you actually want something that has about that's about 12 or 13 degrees in temperature. Remember those glorious days of February?
Yes, the snow in March.
Absolutely longing for that. So actually, you know, this is almost like it's a blast of air conditioning, really, in a sense of this, rather than an evocation of summer. But I just thought it was lovely, and I think more so because it's a music that. It's an tradition for me of people, you know, Paddy McAloon's, the Elvis Costello's, Paul McCartney's. People aren't just sort of great songwriters, but I think they have a sort of a strong regard for the craft of songwriting. Would probably sort of use that word, you know, don't mention themselves, you know, that slightly kind of detached sort of thing, where it's not just about sort of pure autobiography and pure emotion or whatever. You know, they're actually very interested in the craft of songwriting. You can see that, you know, the carpentry of the way the songs put together is just.
That's where I fall asleep, I think.
Yeah, yes. I mean, I know, but I mean, obviously, when people start talking about it, it's tedious. But I think that the outcomes, you know,
there's nothing more boring than a well-crafted song. But that's
This is it. And I said, God, are you talking about well-crafted songs, David? You're beginning, you know, you're boring yourself. You're certainly boring other people, and they're not shy about saying it. Exactly.
Let's get on to your summer read. I wasn't dissing you. It's Peter Gabriel, Global Citizen by Paul Hegarty. Are you a big Peter Gabriel fan?
Well, yes, I am, actually. And I think that, I don't really do the beach holidays because, frankly, these days I've not got much to take a holiday from. You know? I used to do a lot more of these things in the 80s. But the thing is, again, I wouldn't go along and read something that was kind of... I was already on the beach, it was already hot. I didn't really want to read something, you know, Man on a Hot Beach or something like that. It was when I'd mostly read books about
That's
Hitler and stuff like that and the Holocaust. You know, because I thought, if you're going to read these kind of... Yeah.
I'd read that.
Yeah,
So you're going to read Peter Gabriel.
Yeah, no, but I mean, this is really more about, again, sort of trying to challenge that. I've always been very anti-prog. I've always thought that prog rock was this great kind of folly of the early 70s in every respect, you know, and it was based on fundamentally the idea that, like, music white music was on this, white rock music was on this process of graduation. Eventually, it might attain the same status as classical music. And I thought that was fundamentally erroneous. And I thought that a lot of the time it was just people valuing virtuosity over ideas. And the great thing about krautrock at the same time is it's not, even though they're really good players, they're more into concepts and ideas and forms and things like that, rather than just merely being able to play two keyboards at once. But so it's interesting, therefore, to read somebody who is, you know, he's kind of an academic, this guy. And there are elements of, I mean, it's not too dry, you know, but there is, you know, the thing with academics, right? They say what they're about to say, say it, and then say what they've just said. You know, there's elements of that in terms of the structure.
So you just read a third of the book.
Yeah, you could just read the middle bit and get away with it. No, but it's a very, very kind of close reading of everything that Peter Gabriel's done. And it's really, you know, you just think he does him such credit, whatever, and he brings out so much that I'd listened to Peter Gabriel before, quite liked it, but I thought, well, you know, perhaps, David, there's more to Prague, you know, there's more coherence, there's more going on than you may have considered, you know, with your kind of pat put down of it. So, you know, I'm reading really in order to kind of challenge myself, basically.
Excellent. Brian Pern, your thoughts, lastly? Simon Day?
Oh, magnificent. I mean, I just, yeah, Brian Pern's magnificent. I was just always astonished at their capacity to get the guests that they did, because, you know, it's so much of that's always rode on the kind of sheer quality and number of the actual guests that they got, everything, you know, Tony with that humour, whatever. It was
documentary.
Yeah. Brilliant stuff.
Well, I think that's it. I think we're at the end of the show. We've come to the end of the show. And I don't think we had too many intrusive sound effects from people out with the window open, apart from text alerts on my iPad. Thanks to our special guests, David Stubbs and Joe Muggs, for coming down. Please come again. Wasn't too sweaty in here, I hope.
Fine. Thank you very much.
Excellent. David's book, Mars by 1980, The History of Electronic Music, is out soon, and there's a launch event at Foyles Books in London on August the 7th, if you fancy it. Thanks, of course, to Sian Pattenden and to our producer, Sophie Black. Don't forget, you can hear all of our past episodes again, should you wish, at audioboom.com/bigmouth. Go and stack up the phone if you're going on holiday. And if you want to support the show, you can buy us that imaginary virtual pint via patreon.com/bigmouthpodcast. Back next week. Until then, stay hydrated, Britain.